Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum called You're Fired, Trump, Tenure Protection, and the Future of Humphrey's Executor. We're joined by a great panel today made up of Professor Jonathan Adler of Case Western Reserve University School of Law, Dr. Daniel Epstein of St. Thomas University College of Law, Professor Victoria Norris of Georgetown University Law Center, and Will Yateman of Pacific Legal Foundation. And moderating the discussion today, we have Elizabeth Slattery, who is a Director of Constitutional Scholarship at the Pacific Legal Foundation. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. At the end of the program, we can turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. And finally, a note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edith, and good morning. Again, I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Director of Constitutional Scholarship at Pacific Legal Foundation, and I'm delighted to be moderating this discussion. So we are 6 weeks into the new administration, and President Trump has fired several federal officials who enjoy some measure of statutory tenure protection. There's Gwen Wilcox, whose term at the National Labor Relations Board was not set to end until August 2028. Hampton Dellinger from the Office of the Special Counsel, Kathy Harris, the chair of the Merit Systems Protection Board, three members of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, and the list goes on. But a 1935 Supreme Court decision may stand in President Trump's way. In Humphrey's Executor versus United States, the Supreme Court upheld limits on the president's ability to fire members of the Federal Trade Commission at will, reasoning that it was an independent agency with quasi-legislative, quasi-judicial power. Since it didn't exercise executive power, the president did not need to exert direct control over the agency. But the judicial tide has been turning. The Supreme Court has started to walk back Humphrey's executor, with decisions such as Free Enterprise Fund invalidating dual-level insulation and SELA law holding that an agency with a single head like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau may not enjoy tenure protections. And Acting Solicitor General Sarah Harris recently wrote that the administration would no longer defend for-cause removal provisions that apply to members of the FTC, NLRB, as well as the Consumer Protection Safety Commission. Yet Wilcox, Dellinger, and others are pressing their claims in court. So, what may happen as these legal challenges continue? Will the Supreme Court overturn Humphrey's executor? Will Trump supporters come to regret this if the shoe is on the other foot? To unpack all this and more, we're fortunate to have a panel of distinguished speakers with us today. You can read their bios online, very impressive group, but we'll get right to them. I'll just mention the order in which they're going to speak and then hand it off. So first we'll hear from Jonathan Adler, who's a professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Then Will Yateman, who's a senior legal fellow and my colleague at Pacific Legal Foundation, followed by Victoria Norris, who's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. And also she serves as vice chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. And last but not least, Dan Epstein, who's a professor at the St. Thomas University College of Law. So with that, we'll get into our discussion, and we'll start with Jonathan Adler.
There we go. Well, great. It's a pleasure to be here. Great to be here to talk about this very timely topic. As Elizabeth already noted, we have quite a few potential fact patterns that, as I've put it in some writing, put Humphrey's executor in the crosshairs. So what I want to do relatively briefly, so we have lots of time for discussion, is just set the table a little bit about why these actions by President Trump raise the issue of whether Humphrey's executor remains good law or will remain good law, and kind of say a little bit about what the doctrinal background is. So as already noted, President Trump has fired a large number of officials who, at least under federal statute, enjoy protection against presidential removal without cause. This ranges from inspectors general, who for which there's a notice requirement, to various other officials that Elizabeth mentioned, and I think most significant, perhaps for our purposes, the chair of the National Labor Relations Board, where the underlying statute, the National Labor Relations Act, says that removal is only allowed, quote, upon notice and hearing for neglect of duty or malfeasance in office, but for no other cause. A very explicit limitation on the ability of the president to remove an officer. And the question that I think a lot of us are wondering about is whether or not the current Supreme Court believes that this sort of limitation on removal is constitutional, and whether that means jettisoning the 90-year-old precedent of Humphrey's executor. Now, the reason this is something of a debate or something that is so contested is because the Constitution explicitly tells us very little about this question. Article 2 provides for the appointment of officers, but says nothing about removal. The primary provisions about the Constitution that address removal explicitly are about impeachment and removal by Congress. So the question of whether or not the executive, who appoints at least primary officers and many inferior officers, also has the power of removing them is something that has been debated and contested really since the nation's founding. The first Congress addressed this in the context of what's often referred to as the decision of 1789. And at various points in time, Congress has enacted different sorts of statutes purporting to limit the president's power of removal. The first time the Supreme Court entered into this fray was in 1926 in the case of Myers versus United States, a case involving a postmaster, in which the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Chief Justice Taft, held that the president, as the appointing officer, must have the power to remove, that the power to appoint and removal are, in effect, two sides of the same coin, and that the Senate's attempts to require, or the Congress's attempt to require Senate acquiescence or consent to removal was unconstitutional. And Chief Justice Taft rested this conclusion on some inferences from both the Constitution's text and structure, and perhaps also from his own experience having been himself a president of the United States. But he noted that the vesting clause of Article 2 vests the executive power in the president. And so the idea that there is a single president that is in charge of a unitary executive branch, and the Constitution both empowers and obligates the president to see to it that the laws are faithfully executed. And Chief Justice Taft wrote that the president can't fulfill that obligation or exercise that power if the president's underlings, those people that the president will necessarily rely upon to carry out all of the things the executive branch must do, aren't accountable and answerable to the president. And they can't really be accountable and answerable to him if he does not have the ability to remove them if they're not following his direction. Now, Myers split the court. It was not a unanimous opinion, and some of the justices on the court relished the opportunity to revisit or narrow Myers' holding, and that chance came in 1935. We know Franklin Roosevelt is president. He decides that he wants the Federal Trade Commission to be far more aggressive than it had been, and William Humphrey, who had been on the Federal Trade Commission, refuses to leave his office. So Roosevelt fires him, points to Myers versus United States. I have this authority to do it. It goes up to the Supreme Court. It's called Humphrey's executor, not Humphrey versus United States, because Humphrey dies. What the case involves by the time it gets to the Supreme Court is his estate is suing for back pay, suing for the salary. And the court unanimously rejects Franklin Roosevelt's effort to remove Humphrey. Roosevelt is infuriated. By some historical accounts, this case was the final straw that motivated the court packing scheme. And the rationale the court gives is that the FTC's functions were not purely executive like a postmaster. And so the court doesn't overrule Myers, but basically distinguishes it and says purely executive officers president has complete authority to remove. But when Congress creates an entity that has quasi-legislative and quasi-adjudicatory powers that assist the legislature and assist the courts in the performance of their functions, that Congress can insulate such individuals from removal. There's even some language in the opinion that suggests it would be problematic not to insulate such figures from removal by the president. Now, ever since that decision, it has been recognized, at least in the courts, that one of the exceptions to the removal power is when you have an agency that is exercising this sort of authority that Congress has deemed to be or need to be independent. There is a second exception, which we may also talk about, for inferior officers, represented by cases like Morrison versus Olson. And since 1935, the Supreme Court up till now has respected Humphrey's executor as a precedent in terms of what it stands for, that at the very least, a agency, and in particular, an agency that is headed by a multi-member commission that has some sort of bipartisan structure that exercises some range of responsibilities that we might characterize as quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial, can be subject to this sort of protection from removal, whereas other executive branch officers have not. And in recent cases like two that Elizabeth mentioned, Free Enterprise Fund versus Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and Consumer Financial Protection or Sale of Law versus Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the court has embraced a very robust understanding of Myers as a matter of principle, but also sought to distinguish those cases from the facts of Humphrey's executor, the facts of a multi-member commission exercising this range of responsibilities. But if you look at the range of firings that we've seen so far in the Trump administration, there are some, and one in particular I'm just going to flag before closing, that really test the court's attempt to maintain a robust power of presidential removal while preserving the Humphreys precedent. And I think the case that will be hardest for the court to distinguish involves the National Labor Relations Board. The National Labor Relations Board, as I noted, only allows removal upon notice and hearing for neglect of duty or malfeasance in office, but for no other cause. It is a multi-member commission. It has this bipartisan composition. It does engage in adjudications. It does so arguably engages in quasi-judicial activity, although we may discuss that. And this firing in particular, I think, will require the court to revisit or at the very least strain to distinguish Humphrey's executor. And what last thing I'll just note, the Solicitor General, Acting Solicitor General Sarah Harris, has advised the Senate Judiciary Committee that the Justice Department does not plan on defending these various for-cause removal provisions in various statutes because it is the view of the executive branch that these are unconstitutional. And so the Solicitor General's office will be urging the court to overturn Humphrey's as well. I've probably gone on too long, and I will stop there.
Thank you, Jonathan. Will, over to you.
Excellent. Thank you, Elizabeth. I'll note at the outset, it's said that inside the Beltway, it's an insular world. And certainly that's been my experience. This panel is a great example. Professor Adler, he worked at the same small think tank I did. We didn't overlap, but he was a legend there. I took courses under Professor Norse at Georgetown. Elizabeth is my boss. And as for Dr. Epstein, everyone knows Dan. They have known him for a while. So it's a small world here in DC. On to the subject at hand. Regarding Humphrey's executor, per se, even supporters of removal restrictions are hard-pressed to defend that decision on its own terms. This quasi-stuff, it's never passed the sniff test. It's never made sense. Regulatory agencies execute the law, period. That was obviously true in the 1930s, and it's obviously true today. So setting aside Humphrey's, the reasoning in Humphrey's executor, which again, I think is indefensible. There are other ways that these removal restrictions can be defended. I'm not going to rehash that debate here. As Jonathan set forth, this debate has been going on since 1789. No stone has been left unturned. I think it's obvious where my sympathies lie in this particular debate. We all know the arguments. We also know that the only thing that matters, really, is what the Supreme Court thinks, is how they interpret this jurisprudence and this history. On this score, as set forth by Elizabeth and Jonathan, it would seem that doctrinal changes are afoot at the high court. I mean, it seems as though Humphrey's executor definitely is in the crosshairs. So what is my take? Sort of looking prospectively, I think overturning Humphrey's executor, it would be a huge deal as a matter of constitutional law. And overturning Humphrey's executor could indirectly advance big time changes. And I'll address those in a bit. Yet all that said, the practical direct effects of overturning Humphrey's executor wouldn't be that big a deal. And the reason for that is pretty simple. It's because independent agencies are no longer independent. A little history here. So during the 20th century, pretty much the only agency that reliably flipped back and forth, depending on whether or not a Republican or a Democrat was president, was the NLRB. That's changed in the 21st century. And there's empirics to back it up. There's a fantastic 2023 article by Neil Devins, perhaps I'm mispronouncing his last name, and David Lewis. But they show, in essence, that during the Obama administration and the first Trump administration, the so-called independent agencies, they were flip-flopping at the same rate as executive branch agencies. That's fascinating. That's telling and sobering, if you will, if you buy into agency independence. Here, the classic example, the one that many listeners or viewers will be aware of, the FCC and net neutrality. So the FCC chairman, I think Tom Wheeler, had come out publicly against net neutrality. And then Obama, in his second term, applied some of that personal pen and phone lobbying. The FCC chairman flipped. They ended up promulgating a net neutrality policy that has since flipped back and forth, I think, another three times. All right. So my big point there, my perspective point, is that overturning Humphrey's executor, I don't think it would lead to much in the way of practical fallout. And that's because agency independence is largely a myth. There is, however, more to the story. So overturning Humphrey's executor could indirectly bring about big time changes. And what am I talking about here? So the cases that Elizabeth spoke about, the cases that Jonathan spoke about, all these cases, they employ sweeping language about the constitutional imperative for all officers to be accountable to the president, regardless of whether or not the officer is principal or inferior. So what I'm saying here is that the court seems to be moving in a direction that would prohibit tenure for any officer that performs executive functions. So, for example, in Sela Law, the court reimagined Morrison's test for reviewing removal restrictions on inferior officers. So under Morrison, it had been a functional test. After Sela Law, the new test is anyone who wields anything more than minimal discretion or has any policymaking or administrative responsibilities is an inferior officer, presumptively removable at will by the president. So this is a very broad conception of inferior officers. And here's my point. If the court overturns Humphrey's executor, it's possible, and perhaps even likely, that the court will further speak to the constitutional propriety of removal restrictions for inferior officers. And this could be a huge deal. It wouldn't have been a big deal a decade ago. Before about a decade ago, there just weren't that many inferior officers that had tenure protections. It was mainly inspectors general, special counsels, or intra-agency appellate boards. But of course, that changed. It changed in 2016 with Lucia. So all of a sudden, overnight, about 1,000 ALJs changed status from mere employees to inferior officers. And it just recently changed again in a much bigger fashion. And here I'm talking about Trump, the Trump administrations, both the first administration, and they revived it in the second term, the Schedule F. So what does this do? It takes anyone in the civil service who has policymaking discretion, and it makes these employees removable at will. There are like 40,000 to 50,000 such employees, Many of them are SES, Senior Executive Service. And that's basically the cream of the crop of the civil service. So to be sure, the administration is proceeding on a statutory basis with this Schedule F stuff. But if you read the order, it is unequivocally couched, drenched in constitutional terms. I mean, they're clearly basing this action off the Supreme Court's recent interpretation of the president's authority, removal authority over inferior officers. So this is potentially a huge deal. All of a sudden, just in the last, you know, 9 odd years, there are arguably 41,000 inferior officers with statutory tenure. If the court goes about jettisoning Humphrey's executor, and if it contributes to a law that makes these, or a body of law that makes these inferior officers removable at will, that would fundamentally alter the government. And that would be a big deal indeed. So again, the verdict is out regarding the impact that overturning Humphrey's executor would have. The direct impact, not so much. Potentially the big indirect impact, potentially huge. So that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Will. All right, Victoria, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. It's so nice to see one of my students employed. it is a small world, and I'm delighted to have imparted a little bit about statutes to Mr. Yateman. I'm here today. I'm the Whitworth Professor of Law at Georgetown. I've been a tenured professor for a very long time. I've taught at 5 different law schools, including Yale and NYU as a visiting professor. I am the vice chair of the United States Civil Rights Commission. I am not talking about the commission today. In fact, I'm going to use financial examples for all of the during my talk, the Federal Reserve and the FDIC and those kinds of things. I'm also the kind of professor who has no friends because I like to reject the liberal and the conservative position. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. And Will has really, or Mr. Yateman, I should say, has set this up quite well, because I wanted to start with a quote from Justin Walker, who's a judge in Kentucky, wrote an article a couple of years ago where he made this statement. Predicting, and the article predicts that Humphrey's executor will be overturned. I also believe that it will be overturned, but how it is overturned is actually the most important question here. So Judge Walker says some things that Mr. Yateman has said. He says, although administrative and constitutional law scholars will correctly view an overturning of Humphrey's executor as a jurisprudential earthquake, most citizens outside the bubble, including even most lawyers, will likely view its overturning with a collective yawn. Now, let's start with a yawn, and then we'll go to what might be bigger in the same way that Mr. Yateman set up his talk. Now, many years ago, over 20 years ago, I wrote that a president was not very smart. He was either lazy or didn't have good lawyers if he couldn't figure out a cause to fire someone on an independent commission. Cass Sunstein agrees with me. Aditya Bhamsay agrees with me. This is, four cause provisions are very weak protections. There may be some difference in the malfeasance statutes. But it seems to me that the president has been able, for policy reasons, I don't like your policy, to fire these people. And the only barrier is Humphrey's executor. And I agree that the quasi stuff is going to go. This court will not accept that. They're not going to take a functional view, whatever that meant. I never liked that when liberals use that. But I do believe that there is something to fear, because you have to look at what a president gains, whether Republican or Democrat, when you get rid of these things. And it's not simply that it's a nothing burger. You have to fear for a president you don't like, a Democratic president, to do something perhaps arbitrarily, vindictively, to punish loyalists and enemies. Because once for cause is gone, and you can, in fact, say, I don't like your policy. I don't like your transgender policy. I don't like your economic policy. Then the fear is something closer to a failure of due process, a failure of a problem of arbitrary governance. So I think that fear is something that we should take seriously. There have been in the news some recent accounts of individual lawyers, U.S. attorneys and FBI agents who have been fired for various reasons that have caused concern. And I think that's a serious concern. But back back to the yawn for a second. All right. So that's a vindictive question, whether those individuals can have some other kind of claim, let's say, other than the statutory claim for being fired improperly. That's an open question. It may be a constitutional question of some other kind. But back to the yawn, if they were to strike for cause requirements, not much would happen to the administrative state, as Mr. Yeatman said. So the commissions would still run. The federal, the idea is you just cross it out in the statute. They're severable, as the court has said in a couple of cases. So then you're done. You're just crossing out a line in a code. And I think we should pause at that too. So we should pause about that because it could portend in what the Supreme Court called in a case called Skinner versus Oklahoma that I wrote a book about eugenics, what would happen in evil or reckless hands. The court has always wanted to know what the limiting principles are. And this is a question you have to think of the alternatives for a president you like or a president you dislike. And let's say we just cross out the line in the statutes. But what happens on day five? Let us imagine a Democratic president firing all Republican officials on all commissions. There are many such commissions. It's not just the NLRB, it's nuclear safety, safety of baby cribs, not to mention the world's greatest economy, Federal Reserve, FDIC, banking reserves, commodities markets. And this has always been Paul Clement's argument when he was arguing for the FHFA. The problem here is that these commissions come in various varieties. And so even if you hate Humphrey's executor and want it to be overruled, this argument's going to come up. At least for some of these multi-member commissions, and this is why this is different than, say, Hampton Dellinger or the inferior officer question that Mr. Yeatman raised. If you get rid of one or two commissioners, just I don't agree with your policy, then they have no quorum. Okay, so if President Trump were to, and that has happened at the NLRB and the EEOC today, they don't have a quorum. There are only two people at the NLRB, same with the EEOC. And the question then is that shuttering the agency in effect legislative power? Does it violate Justice Black's opinion in Steele seizure? That's one question. And the second question is, whether it's possible in these multi-member commissions to actually chop up the statute the way the easy fix seems. So the easy fix seems right. We've seen it in Collins. The court has gone around trying to find easy ways to do this by jiggering statutes around. But once you do that, there are other consequences to the statutory structure. And the statutory structure is typically to avoid appointment by one president. So you have a 15-year term for the Federal Reserve. So that is, I believe, the big deal. Yes, there's Schedule F and inferior officers. We can talk about that. There's a separate part of the appointments clause that affects inferior officers that we should note, perhaps in the questions and about Schedule F. They have to be, Congress needs to create these offices by law, as Justice Thomas has indicated in the immunity case. So that's a wrinkle. But in general, I think this is the kind of argument that the overruling of Humphrey's executive order will actually yield. It won't be about the NLRB or the Civil Rights Commission or tons of the tiny little boards that probably should disappear as a policy matter. I'm all for government efficiency. But there are big deal agencies here that govern our economy. And that has to be answered for any prudent judge, I believe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, Dan, bring us home.
Last but not least, I am generally sympathetic to the overturn Humphrey's view. I would just say in my time in the executive branch, the Office of Legal Counsel had a very strident position that, Humphrey's executor has been overturned in effect over time. So that's not surprising. I kind of am interested in the history of how we got these so-called independent commissions, because I think the history might add some sympathy to understanding what was going on. So if you look at the 1924 case of FTC versus American Tobacco, what is kind of front and center of that case is the reality that when the Federal Trade Commission Act was passed and signed in 1914, the FTC was quite restrained in how it did investigations. It would have to get essentially consent via a Senate resolution before it issued a petition for documents and information. And that is, we might have constitutional problems or objections with that, but I think it's relevant to understanding why the court may have thought of this commission as kind of quasi-legislative. And that's for two reasons. and I'll allude to that with kind of the reality, and I'm sure everyone here knows this reality, but it's not spoken about enough. If you look at the key kind of removal cases from the early part of the 20th century, Myers, which happened after FTC versus American Tobacco, 2 years after Humphreys, 1935, and then Wiener in the 50s, all of those cases arose in the Court of Federal Claims. Court of Claims, as it was called then. In other words, they were all cases where standing was not based off some kind of mandamus argument or other kind of constitutional argument, but was based off the fact that when you remove me, I don't get paid and I'm entitled to back pay. And so we should kind of, I think, two interesting questions. Number one, why don't we actually remove all the current kind of removal cases to the Court of Claims? We have a very good majority of conservatives in that court. And then what do all these cases say about standing? You know, why if the history was that you had to kind of plead, I was entitled to more pay because I had 2 years left on my term, why then is the kind of standing calculus different now? The reason why the Court of Claims fact is interesting is because historically, claims for money damages against the United States, in other words, I served in a war, I was entitled to certain pay, Treasury must pay me. The history of that was that you filed a petition in Congress, and that is what was known by private bills. Yeah, we have public laws, private laws in the early Congress. And those private bills were actually adjudications by the committees that then created those private bills to award money damages. And in fact, what do we learn? What's the origin of all delegation? Congress pleads that the workload is too much. And so you get the delegation of this petition process to the Court of Claims. That's what the Tucker Act does. And so that, I think, provides useful context for why Humphreys said, well, the FTC is just a legislative aid. Because you look at these facts. Court of Claims is adjudicating petitions about money damages that previously were subject to the oversight of committees. 1914, 21 years before the Humphreys decision, it was clear that the FTC couldn't issue these investigative subpoenas without a congressional resolution. That seems like they're not so different than a committee of Congress. And so I think that brief history is relevant to kind of understanding some of the background as to why the court may have decided what it decided. I would say that one very clear argument is that the FTC, when it was established in 1914, is not the FTC of today. The FTC does not get authority to investigate from Senate resolutions. And so I think just on those facts, there's a reason to say, look, these aren't like legislative committees anymore. I think, you know, one thing that is easy, low-hanging fruit, is looking at Bowser versus Sinar. Bowser versus Sinar, I think, presents lots of problems if we just look at kind of the formalist view. The Comptroller General is presidentially appointed and Senate confirmed. The Comptroller General clearly exercises executive power. If you are a government contractor and you're subject to a bid protest, some of those bid protests could come before the Comptroller General, who adjudicates them. The Comptroller General can enforce subpoenas against contractors directly in Article III court. That all seems like executive branch activity. Yet why did the Supreme Court say that the Comptroller General is still a legislative officer? And so I think that might present a problem in the view of overturning Humphreys. But I also think, you know, if Humphreys was wrong, certainly Bowser versus Sinar was wrong. The other thing I'll say is I kind of just like anyone else who's aggressively critical about the administrative state. I am a unitary executive person. The problem I have with just kind of saying, and I agree with Will on this, just saying, oh, let's overturn Humphreys, and then, you know, the administrative state is incredibly weak. We have a problem with these so-called independent agencies. And the problem is really that lawyers in Washington make a ton of money from them. It is very profitable to represent a respondent in SEC investigations or CFPB investigations or CFTC investigations. And so the lawyers have very high opportunity costs in kind of getting rid of these agencies or giving more presidential supervision. I think the other thing is, and this goes to the problem of independent agencies, is that they're easily captured by special interests. And this kind of goes, it hangs together with the lawyer piece. And so as long as the president is put in a position of supervising agencies where their agenda setting is highly dependent upon special interests, we can't achieve a unitary executive. The president just can't simply control, you know, the hundreds of agencies and institutions in the government when they're captured by special interests and where they're kind of dispersed as they are. And so what's really the solution? And then I'll add another thing. There's some reasons or some justifications for why presidents like these multi-member boards. They can make political compromises. I'll put your two people on, Senator Schumer, if you put my three people on and you don't hold them up and all of that. So we still have that problem of the politics. But the last thing I'll say is that I think the real reform here, and I think this is true with virtually everything in terms of restoring a unitary executive, getting rid of the administrative state and all of that, is we really need to focus on the Executive Branch Reorganization Act authority. I know the Executive Branch Reorganization Act of 1977 sunsetted, but that's not to say that we can't bring back a statute and totally reform the administrative state, right? You look at what FDR did with his Executive Branch Reorganization Authority, massive reform. In my view, the FTC shouldn't be independent of the Commerce Department. CFTC shouldn't be independent of Treasury, or SEC shouldn't be independent of Treasury. That is kind of the ideal administrative state reform that I would like. And otherwise, I'd like to return these quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative commissions back to Congress. Let's make Congress great again. Let's have our golden age, the unitary executive that is not captured by special interests as it exists today.
Thank you, Dan. Well, I'm all for making Congress great again and making them work again. So before we jump into audience Q&A, and it looks like we've got an active audience with questions. So for other audience members, if you have a question, just hit the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen and you can type in a question. But I wanted to offer everyone the opportunity to respond. Does anyone want to respond to any of your co-panelists' points?
I've got a quick thing to say. Agree 100% with Professor Norris regarding the importance that courts got to work out of the financial institutions, how the fallout would affect them. That's the big elephant in the room. I'll note this. So there are arguments that, in particular, the Fed, that this money management is purely legislative, that it somehow elides executive power. I don't necessarily buy into that. Actually, I don't buy into it at all. That said, I'm largely ignorant of these things. My point, there's a political constraint. There's a political cost. No president is willing to incur the blowback, or rare is the president, I'd imagine, that's willing to incur the blowback. And even Trump, whom I think we'll all agree is gives himself more latitude and is willing to break norms and whatnot. Even he accepted the Fed's money management role from all these efforts, these executive orders that reach independent agencies. And he's doing so because he doesn't want to be wrong and then torpedo the GOP's chances to win the presidency in 2028. So it is true. That is the big matzo ball out there, that of the Fed in particular, and what its status would be in a world without Humphrey's executor. All that being said, you know, there are, and they're perhaps underreported, there are serious political constraints that would keep a president from ever going hog wild on the Fed.
Any other comments, thoughts, responses? Okay, hearing none. So one question I have, I'd love to know, what do you all think the Supreme Court opinion would look like if they end up taking one of these cases directly challenging Humphrey's executor? Do you think they will continue along the Free Enterprise Fund, Selah Law, Collins path to just sort of continue to shrink the scope of what Humphreys covers, or will they rip the Band-Aid off? What does Chief Justice Roberts' opinion look like?
I'll start on that. A lot depends on which case comes to them first. So, for example, if you look at the Dellinger case, the case of the special counsel and the Office of Special Counsel, there are two easy ways to distinguish that case from Humphrey's executor. Certainly, and by easy, I mean, you know, involve no more of a stretch than prior Chief Justice Roberts' opinions in this space, right? On the one hand, one could argue that it's distinguishable because perhaps the special counsel is an inferior officer, is more like the other sort of special counsel, and perhaps also because of the adjudicatory nature that the special counsel is perhaps more like an ALJ, which at least at the time of Lucia, both the government and the petitioners concluded that ALJs at the SEC were inferior officers. So you can distinguish it that way. Conversely, if the court wants to uphold the removal of the special counsel, the court could simply say, single-headed agency, this is Selah Law, this is Collins, we don't have to reach Humphrey's executor. So if a case like that is the first one the court has to write on, the court can either affirm or reject the Trump administration's attempt to remove Dellinger without disturbing Humphrey's executor. I think the Merit Systems Protection Board is a little more difficult. You don't have that single member out, but maybe there are ways of characterizing what the Merit Systems Protection Board does sufficiently differently than the way we think about more traditional independent agencies that have a regulatory function. The last thing I'll note, and this has been hinted at a little bit in Dan's remarks, Ali Nakamani has a paper on this, Dan Crane has a paper on this. One could actually also say that the NLRB, the FTC, the SEC, et cetera, as they exist today, are more like, say, the EPA or more like traditional executive agencies than they are the FTC at the time of 1935. And therefore, Humphrey's executor is still good law if you have an agency that is acting like the FTC did in 1935, but is not good law if the only difference between the purportedly independent agency and the executive branch agency is the number of people at the top running it. That sort of distinction won't please many people. It arguably allows the Chief Justice to make one less check mark on how many precedents did my court overturn this year list. But the court could do that if its goal was to say, look, we're just not dealing with the same question that the court did in 1935. And that would be another way. Now, I don't expect that because I think it might be hard to get five votes for that view. Even in a case like the NLRB case, it's certainly possible that we will see something like that. Lastly, I'll just note, you have any case where there are provisions that insert Congress into the removal process, I think the administration wins. You don't get anywhere near Humphrey's executor. You can rest that squarely on the holding of Myers. I think that includes the notice requirements for removing inspectors general. And any statute that didn't include an express removal express removal language. The court can just say, well, we may have thought there was removal protection, but Congress didn't put it in the statute, so too bad. So the EEOC, for example, I think falls into that bucket. Arguably, the SEC does as well, although the court has said in prior opinions, we assume that there is removal, even though the statute doesn't say, or removal protection, even though the statute doesn't say so.
You know what happens when you assume. Does anyone else have thoughts on what the Supreme Court's opinion may look like?
Well, I think Professor Adler's right that in terms of, you know, you could distinguish Humphrey's executor away because it actually doesn't have any analogs. I mean, if it exists at all in these cases. I do think that the multi-member cases are different than the single agency cases, as I might my comments suggest, and they're harder. So the single agency cases, Josh Matz, who's representing Hampton Dellinger, is relying on him being an inferior officer. And of course, Congress must create these offices by law, and the question is what that means. I think that the multi-members are going to get you into more the problem of addressing the kinds of agencies that I'm talking about. And again, there's an argument that just placing SEC and Treasury doesn't really do anything. But I do think the NLRB case raises the probability that the question of what happens when you do these removals to essentially hollow out an entire agency. And that's a new thing.
So one audience question, someone would like to know if anyone wants to comment on Judge Jackson's opinion in the Dellinger case, specifically what kind of authority does that office exercise if it's not executive? Dan.
Yeah, so I've had a number of run-ins with the Office of Special Counsel. I think it's unconstitutional. Particularly this idea, I mean, the argument that Amy Berman Jackson made was, look, it's internal affairs. It's internal affairs. It has no effect, no kind of force of law on the public. But in many ways, it's kind of the worst form of law enforcement, because it has the ability to interfere with principal officers. This whole Hatch Act business says that if you're a close advisor to the president, you could essentially be subject to removal by the president. I mean, you know, Kellyanne Conway in the 45th presidential administration was subject to a number of these attacks. And so it directly interferes with the president's official authority. And that should be reason enough for the president to remove the special counsel in one fell swoop. I don't buy the argument that the special counsel doesn't have law enforcement authority. I would also note that they can represent whistleblowers before the MSPB. And then kind of the worst sin is they can disclose all sorts of what would be presumed to be confidential information to minority members of Congress, minority members who are different party than the president, which, you know, is kind of, in my view, a mark of being kind of an executive function.
Any other thoughts?
I'll know one thing, and I actually blogged about this over the weekend. It is interesting to look back at SALA law and to see how the court in SALA law and Chief Justice Roberts' opinion addressed the Office of Special Counsel. Right. So in that case, those defending the constitutionality of the CFPB identified three existing agencies with headed by a single individual that would arguably be affected by declaring that the president could remove the head of the CFPB at will. So the Social Security Administration, which may be sui generis since it deals with benefits, the Federal Housing Finance Administration, which we know was addressed in Collins, and which the court really made almost no effort to distinguish. But with regard to the Office of Special Counsel, the court, on the one hand, noted that, you know, this wasn't created until The 1970s, the Office of Legal Counsel under President Carter had raised concerns about the constitutionality of the office. Reagan had initially vetoed the legislation creating it. It was eventually created by legislation signed by President Bush. So I guess in 1990 was when it was finally created. And then the court says, in any event, the Office of Special Counsel exercises only limited jurisdiction to enforce certain rules governing federal government employers and employees. It does not bind private parties at all or wield regulatory authority comparable to the CFPB. And I think, you know, that as Professor Norse noted, you Dellinger's briefing relies on this idea to say that the office, whatever Dr. Epstein's concerns about it are, could at least be characterized as at least as inferior as the other sort of special counsel. Now, whether or not the current court wants to preserve that precedent either, not so sure.
So the flip side to the removal power is, of course, the appointment power, which the Constitution does have plenty to say about. But I'm curious, this has been an area that the court has been active in as well. You know, with Lucia, for example, holding that SECs, ALJs are not employees, but they are some kind of officer. Do you see this as an area where the court has an appetite to, you know, further delineate the line between inferior and principal officers, as well as, you know, make the line clearer between mere employees and officers, whatever kind they may be? Anyone?
That's a hard thing. You know, they've been trying to avoid that for a very long time. They've made some attempts. You know, you have to have a superior to, you know, be an inferior. I mean, that's kind of tautological. I don't think they really want to do that. The question is whether there is a suit that's essentially claiming that DOJ has not been properly appointed, because given the amount of executive authority being exerted, that person must be appointed as a principal officer and confirmed by the Senate. So you could see it in an entirely different form than most people think it at this point. I think that, you know, they don't want, well, I mean, I'd be interested to hear what the other professors or Mr. Yateman think about this, but I don't, divining that line is very, very fraught. They don't want to, I mean, Collins says, we don't even want to get into the amount of executive power. So I'm reading from that, you know, perhaps Mr. Dellinger is doomed if he's exerting executive power. And that would suggest that they don't want to get into that, although they may be forced into it with another different kind of challenge.
I agree with that. I think with the exception of Justices, I guess, Thomas and Gorsuch, Thomas has his concurrence in Lucia that adopts the theory articulated in a Law Review article by Jennifer Mascott on a very broad view of what counts an officer. So, you know, there are two justices that are very comfortable with where the line is. I think that for the rest of them, there is this trepidation about precisely how do you draw a line that can be serviceable and usable. But I think, you know, their ability to avoid making that sort of judgment is going to be constrained, particularly if there are lower courts that are willing to act aggressively in this space. I mean, I don't think the court has as much control over its agenda in this space as I think at least the Chief Justice wishes it had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Shoot, I'll echo what both professors said. And just note that it's not just a function of adventurism, perhaps bold stances by the lower courts. It's an administration priority. I mean, across the board, this administration is unstated, but they're pressing every issue. There's, you know, we've got these hazy lines between the branches of government. We've got these hazy lines between mere employees, inferior officers, and principal officers. This administration is keen on getting to the bottom of these questions. It's a strategy. So, you know, it is that, in addition to the fact that the only people who seem to have standing and are irreparably harmed and have justiciability are the people who lost their jobs. You know, it's just setting up we're going to get a lot of answers, I'd imagine.
I think we have time for one more question. So following the, in the weeks following the election, there was a lot of chatter about the possibility of recess appointments. But it seemed like President Trump had a compliant Senate so far. But let's fast forward and let's say the Senate flips for the second half of the Trump administration, or look, you know, a few years into the future, a future administration where the president and the Senate are different parties. Do you think the current court has an appetite to revisit parts of Noel Canning? You know, some say it leaves something to be desired for textualists and originalists. So do you think we may see a recess appointments challenge in the future that the court would seize upon?
I'll just say the thing to think about in some of these sorts of spaces is that I think it's very clear if Noel Canning were decided today, Justice Scalia's approach would command the majority. The question is whether or not there are enough justices who feel it's worth overturning the precedent. I mean, Gorsuch and Thomas aren't particularly concerned about overturning precedent. They've both indicated that the justices take an oath to the Constitution, not to their own prior decisions, and therefore have no obligation to uphold prior decisions. Clearly, the Chief Justice does not feel that way. I think we're still learning the extent to which Kavanaugh and Barrett feel that precedent is important, especially in areas like this, where it's long been understood that the way the branches interact with each other adds meaning to the relatively sparse text. And so, you know, I'm sure Thomas and Gorsuch and probably Alito would love to try and get the Scalia Noel Canning concurrence to be the law of the land. This is just a space where it's not clear there is a majority that feels the need to reorient every aspect of the court's jurisprudence again, because this is an area where the court has often looked to the unbroken practice of the political branches as a way of understanding what their respective authorities are.
I would just add, so part of this is just raw politics. If the president finds himself in a situation where he needs to get appointees through, judges, others, and there's a opposite party controlling the Senate, I think this might be the administration where the president threatens to use this kind of occasions clause power, which is to say, you know, fine, Supreme Court, you don't want to allow me to do intercession recess appointments. I'm determining that it's an extraordinary occasion. I'm going to convene both houses as to the time of when they should adjourn. And if there's disagreement, we're adjourning and I'm going to appoint all my people. That might motivate the court to be more flexible.
Well, on that note, we've just about come to the end of our time. So I want to thank our panelists and thank everyone for joining us today. This was a lively discussion. So thank you all.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Yeah, and just to echo that, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Adler, Dr. Epstein, Professor Norris, and Will for speaking with us today, and Elizabeth for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your active participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsec.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.